Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget. Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. This week, kind of a supersized episode because my guest, Tracy Newman, was just so damn interesting that I didn't want to edit out a thing. Now, Tracy Newman is an Emmy-winning TV writer, a musician. She did card stunts on The Tonight Show and was a founding member of the improv group The Groundlings. If the name Newman sounds kind of familiar, it's because her younger sister, Lorraine Newman, became one of the original members of the Not Ready for Primetime Players on Saturday Night Live. Now, if you read my blog a couple of weeks ago when Ricky Jay passed away, Tracy, who knew him and lived with him, wrote a marvelous tribute for the blog. And if you want to go back and read it, if you haven't already, it is the November 27th post. Anyway, she's very interesting, has had a great career, several careers, and here's something that should really be heartening for a lot of people trying to break into the writing world. She got her first writing job at the age of 46. Let's meet Tracy Newman. So, Tracy, you've done an awful lot of things. You were a folk singer back in the day when when folk singing...
Back in the day before you were out in the world.
You know, in the early 60s, that was the rage, folk singing and hootenannies and that type of thing. And did you see yourself as a singer, that was going to be your career, that you were going to be Mary of Peter, Paul, and Mary?
No, definitely not
Peter,
that.
Peter, Paul, and Tracy? Yeah.
No, I started playing guitar when I was 14, you know, and I had relatives that sang and played. They were in the folk scene, and Theodore Bickel was in that group, sort of, and I kind of knew him, but, you know, but periphery, because I was a kid.
Right.
And I played guitar pretty well, I mean, right away, you know, I loved it. So I just drifted into playing in small clubs in town when I got to be 18, 19 in L.A., and I was one of the first acts at in Huntington Beach at the Golden Bear. In fact, I think the owner thinks I was the first act, but I kind of don't think I was. And at the Troubadour, I was playing the Hootenannies, and, you know, I just was—and I wasn't writing at that time. I was really just singing, you know, like the Kingston Trio.
Okay.
That was it. I mean, when I say I played the guitar well, that's the kind of stuff I played, which is three chords.
So what are you more proud of, being the first performer at the Golden Bear or your Emmy?
It depends on who the crowd is. I think probably my Emmy, because your crowd's probably more interested in that. More impressed.
So how did you go from that to comedy?
Well, I went in 1965, I went to New York, and I literally went to be a star. I mean, I was one of those kids.
The whole Greenwich Village scene and yeah. Dylan and all those people.
Yeah, I just went there.
Do you know him?
Thinking,
do you hang out with him?
No, I never met Bob Dylan. But people used to say that, oh, Dylan was here again tonight at the Bitter End.
Uh-huh.
And I think he was at the Gaslight or Gertie's Folk City on the at the Times when I had my shows.
Uh-huh.
And I was the MC there, so I never left.
Uh-huh.
You know, the whole year I played there off and on, I was like the opening act, and I was, and I think he just came to, would drop in. Jack Elliott used to do it too, and I never met either of them.
Wow. And were you young enough that Woody Allen hit on you?
Yeah, no, he didn't hit on me. But he was there. He would come to the Bitter End, and Dick Cavett.
Uh-huh.
I became sort of friendly with Dick Cavett at the time. And Patchett and Tarsus were an
uh-huh.
act back then.
They became a comedy writing duo.
Yes.
And they pretty much were the showrunners of the Great Bob Newhart Show.
Yep.
And they went on to do Buffalo Bill. And Tom went on to do Alf.
Yep.
And
what a different sensibility,
yes, yes.
those two guys.
And Jay went off to do other things. And just before they were doing the pilot of Alf, because we had worked with them on the Tony Randall Show, and we knew Tom and Jay. And they had broken up by this time. And I bumped into Tom with his family, and they were at a restaurant, you know, in Santa Monica. And I said to him, so, hey, Tom, how's it going? And he said, how's it going? I'm directing a pilot starring a fucking puppet. That's how it's going. Well, that fucking puppet was Alf, and he's probably now a billionaire.
Yeah,
so,
I'm sure he's a billionaire.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny. I always thought that Tarsus was the sort of the really clever one, but did he sort of disappear?
Well, he did Days and Nights of Molly Dodd.
Uh-huh. And he did good with some good stuff.
Yeah, and he did Slap Maxwell
mm-hmm.
and
stuff
other
that didn't
things.
Really catch
yeah,
on.
Yeah, both.
I mean,
of
they
them
got on the air.
Wonderfully
yeah.
funny.
Really,
yeah.
Slap Maxwell was great.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, Molly Dodd was too. Was that
Blair Brown? Yeah.
Oh, I loved her too.
Yeah.
You know the Jamie Tarsus
right.
became what the head of ABC.
Yeah, and NBC.
And Matt Tarsus became a writer too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had
Jay's
run-ins
kids.
With them too.
Yeah. And the irony, of course, is that Jay hated. Network executives. Just hated network executives. When I was on the Tony Randall Show and the network would call, Tom would have to take the call because Jay would get too angry. And for his daughter to become a network executive, you know, it's like the priest's daughter, you know, becoming a whore, you know.
Do you remember, you used to pitch to her?
Yes.
Do you remember how she would sit in the chair with her legs under her, you know, like I sit there that way too in those big chairs.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just like, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And I remember we did a pilot for Brian Regan, who we loved. And I think they put us onto that. We didn't, like, look for him. I think they put us with him. And then we wrote it, and we worked with him and everything. And it was very exciting and really terrific, we thought. And we went to her with it, and she said, no, I don't think he's a star. And this was after, you know, putting us with him. I don't
yeah.
know if she personally put us with him, but, you know, it was... You know, and
Jay did a pilot for her and got notes.
Mm-hmm.
Got notes from,
her.
From his daughter.
Oh, wow.
And
oh,
she,
actually, I think I heard something
yeah,
about this.
She started the meeting by going, you know, Dad, this isn't your best work. And Jay said, you know what, Jamie, neither were you.
Neither were you.
Yeah.
Oh, God. That's so, what a rough situation.
So you wound up in the Groundlings.
I did, yeah. Well, you asked me, though, how I ended up in comedy. And,
okay.
And I have to say that at that time when I was emceeing at the Bitter End in 1965, I would work till maybe midnight there, and then I'd go to the improv. At 44th and 9th, which was the original improv.
Okay.
And the improv at that time was the Algonquin Roundtable, really, what became of that in a way. I mean, it was Rodney Dangerfield and Richard Pryor and Robert Klein and, I mean, really everyone. Bette Midler was there.
Wow.
Liza Minnelli
uh-huh.
hung out there. Everybody hung out at the improv after their gigs. So it was not it had no alcohol. And we would be there till 4 in the morning performing for each other.
Uh-huh.
And I was one of the few singers. I mean, like when I say Bette Midler was there, I never saw her sing. And Liza Minnelli. But like Liza Minnelli was at the time, as I recall, was kind of a fan because I was doing a Beatles medley. That's around the time that was. And, you know, I hung out with Rodney, and Ron Carey was my boyfriend for a while. Do you remember Ron Carey?
Yeah, right. He was on Barney Miller for a while.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had dates with other guys back then, but I think he was my only, like, kind of steady boyfriend.
You went out with him twice.
Yes.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so I gravitated to the comedians as opposed to the musicians. And so for me to end up in comedy is not that strange, really.
Uh-huh.
You know, the music was kind of my own thing, my own business. But to hang out with musicians, I found to be, I hate to say this, guys, you don't care anymore, I'm sure. But back then, some of you did. To be in a studio where people are recording was the most boring thing to me. It still is. Even when I'm doing my own stuff, I get in there and out as fast as I can. It's just not that interesting to me.
Uh-huh.
And maybe it's because I'm not really a great musician. You know, it's partly that, I'm sure. In fact, it's probably all that.
So what brought you back to Los Angeles?
Well, I stayed in New York for 2 years. I had a million things happen that taught me really everything you need to know about show business. You know, I mean, I told
good
you
good and
bad. Mostly bad. I mean, uh-huh. Back then, when you know, when you're in your early 20s and opportunity strikes,
right.
You think it's a dime a dozen. You think it's going to happen all the time. And so you don't really treat them with the seriousness that I'm like. Ed McMahon, for instance, was my manager.
Wow.
And The Tonight Show was already on the air. So think about that. He had never managed anybody. He came in, we went to the same vocal coach. That's where we met. I had to perform for him. He had to perform for me. That's how this guy ran his thing. And he went to his manager and said, I'd like to manage this girl. I think she's whatever he said to him. And he had the Tonight Show, Sally Schultz was the only name I remember, but the writers write a show called Travels with Tracy. For children.
Okay.
So he saw something there that I didn't get yet. I didn't really understand it, but he thought I would be a great performer for children. And, you know, I wore a little cap and boots and, you know, I was cute, you know.
I'm sure you were.
And then, you know, I proceeded to ruin every network pitch and just by it, like, thinking, what is this? You know, whereas you learn, when you're in TV to keep your mouth shut, really, is what you learn.
Right.
And go along with what's going on until something happens that you can't stand. And then maybe you speak up. But this was, you know, I didn't have much sympathy for the tough spot that he was in when he was having to pitch to these young network guys when he was a celebrity.
Right.
And here's this girl coming in from having been at the Improv at 4 a.m, you know, and dragging in with her guitar. I mean, really, I screwed up everything. I really did. But so I had a lot of opportunities like that. And when I left, I ran from New York. I just literally ran away. Uh-huh. I just thought, I'm just terrible. And I quit. Quit show business. I quit everything.
Okay.
And I became a nursery school teacher.
What got you back?
I saw an ad for a class, an improv class, that this guy Gary Austin was teaching. And I don't remember where I saw the ad, but I mean, I was teaching nursery school. And I went and took the class, and there was like Tim Matheson was in it, and Pat Morita, and Jack Sue, and Valerie Curtin,
okay.
And Archie Hahn.
And this was the Groundlings.
Well, it became the Groundlings.
Groundlings.
And Tom Maxwell was there, who became, you know,
writer.
Who took over. Yeah, and he also took over the Groundlings when Gary left.
Mm-hmm.
And we became like the founding members, really essential founding members were me and Tom and Gary. I'm not saying my sister wasn't important, obviously.
Right.
I mean, Lorraine Newman.
Her sister is Lorraine Newman.
Yeah. And very early on, Lily Tomlin and Lorne Michaels came to the show and tried to take a few people.
Right.
You know, Lorne. He took Lorraine, but he tried to get Archie and Liberty, Louise Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Liberty at the time. And, and I drifted towards directing and teaching and writing.
Right.
And so, and John Stark was in the... I'm heading to
your
television.
Partner.
Yeah, he became a member of the Groundlings, and we started looping together a lot. We were in this looping group, and he said to me, "You know, Bill and Sherry are running Cheers. They want us to write a, they want me, him, to write a spec script. Can you type? It was almost that kind of thing, you know, because I found him very funny. So I
he didn't think you would be necessarily a partner because, you know, you had that, I think that he thought, small lady brain kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think he thought I had a good sense of what was funny because I laughed at everything he said.
Okay.
Almost.
Okay.
So it turned out when we had our first meeting and we started writing, I actually said to myself, there's no end to this. We can go all the way. I know what to do with this guy. Uh-huh. It was like having a big lump of clay, you know? That, I mean, that's not a smart way to put that. I mean, what I guess what I'm trying to say is he was manageable and so funny to me. I thought, if he's funny to me, it's got to be funny to at least a quarter of the population. Right?
So you molded him to where he was doing the typing.
No. Well, no. I was doing the typing, and but I was forming the stories, and, you know, I was kind of getting it together and organizing it. And I didn't realize at the time, but that kind of is what the work
job
is.
It is
the job. And he was pitching and also coming up with great story ideas, too.
Right.
I mean, it's not like he couldn't do that. And it was so much fun, even though it was a difficult partnership, but it was so much fun for me that I just thought, this is, I'm going to make a living at this.
Right. I want to back up for a second.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in college, my best friend and roommate was a guy named Billy Pearl, and we both went into radio after college, and he had a meteoric rise. He was 24 years old, and he was on KHJ Los Angeles, which was the big top 40 radio station.
And his name was Billy
Pearl? Billy Pearl, yeah. And we're friends. Like I say, we're friends, and we're roommates in college. And for about a 2-3 year period, every time I would bump into a mutual friend, the first thing he would say to me was, "Hey, how's Billy?" Or, "Hey, I've been listening to Billy. Billy sounds great." And I wanted to say, "Hey, ask about me, how I am." Okay? How is it for you when your sister is on Saturday Night Live?
Well, that's a question, by the way, that many people ask me, because emotionally you'd think that would be like, you know, trouble.
Yeah, but they don't do the Billy Pearl intro, right?
I knew Lorraine was funny because I was her. I'm 9 years older than her.
Okay.
And so I kind of raised, she has a twin, Paul.
Okay.
I raised them in the way that my mother wouldn't, you know, didn't care about going out with pushing them in the stroller and all that stuff. So, I mean, I was very useful at home. So I knew how funny she was in a way. But when I took her to the Groundlings to her first class at the Groundlings and saw what she could do in the first class, I thought, this is a whole other level from what's going on in here, except for Valerie Curtin, who is also capable of that.
Okay.
But I was completely blown away. So I don't know. I mean, it's like, I couldn't do that. I don't do characters. It just seemed like the right thing. I drifted towards teaching. I wasn't really competitive as a performer because I wasn't that good at it, frankly.
Right.
I mean, there were people that thought I was good because came from nothing. but really, you know, the people who know improv, they know sort of where I stand. Or, you know.
Did you find the same thing happen to you, though, that people would come up to you and go, "Hey, I saw Lorraine on Saturday Night. Yeah, fantastic."
No, there's an insensitivity that happens.
Right.
You know, they are not very curious about me.
Right.
Except, can I get them to Lorraine? You know,
can I
introduce them to Lorraine, which I did a lot. You know?
You guys still close?
Oh, yeah. She just lived with me for a year because she and her husband broke up, and she was looking for a place, and she was remodeling the place she found. And so we had fun. We had never done that before. Yeah, no, we're very, in fact, she's like, except for Lynn Stewart, my best friend, mm-hmm. she's my other best friend.
Okay. Bouncing around,
mm-hmm.
but every partnership is different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been in one for years with David Isaacs.
Who's about the easiest guy in the world to me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he put up with me for a year, so. But we always would work head to head. You know, we would have a writer's assistant in the room taking down the dictation, but we always wrote head to head. How did you and Jonathan wrote
everything together. I mean, if that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's not, did one act and he did the other and then you traded and all that kind of stuff.
I'm not saying we never did that, but most of the time, 99.9% of the time we were, because it was, that's what was fun to me, because he was so funny to me. And I just want to say, though, I did not like having a writer's assistant with us, which is an interest. I preferred typing. One of the reasons was it's another human being in the room, and it's really a threesome then. Right. Even if you tell them don't ever speak, which you can't do and you wouldn't do, really, they pitch. And it becomes this other sensibility. And it isn't that it would be bad or good, but it was trouble for me. It would be like if I'm the person typing, then I become the writer's assistant in a way. I mean, I'm both things, but if the other person's typing, I feel like the person typing has the control.
Okay.
That's maybe the best way to put that. I didn't even think of that, but that's probably what it is. And I needed to have the control. And so if a person was going to pitch and you were going to say no or ignore their pitch, you're now dealing with another emotional situation sometimes. Because I know how it feels. We all know.
Right.
And so I needed to type.
You haven't had the experience, the joy of pitching something and saying, yeah, okay, that's good. Lana, put that in. And then have her go, really?
No, I haven't.
Really?
Is that Lana Williams?
What?
Was that Lana Williams?
Lana Lewis.
Lana Lewis?
Lana Lewis, yeah. She was great. She was great.
I'm thinking of someone else, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? It's a dynamic that I had trouble with. John didn't have trouble with that, but I personally needed to be in control.
We liked it because it kind of freed us up.
No, it totally would, but I couldn't do it.
And after a while, and this may sound strange to some people, but you know how you think in terms of, okay, I need the next line, I need the next joke. But after a while, I would think in terms of whole runs, you know, like a whole page run. And so I would say, here, get this down. We'll clean it up and change it and eliminate half of it and everything. But I could just then vomit out a page run. And then we would have that to work off of. And it was just a lot easier to go.
To work.
Yeah, to go. Oh, you know what? Why don't we bring Norm in earlier? And so you say, you know, why don't you bring Norm in here instead of here, and they, the good ones, would actually do it.
Yeah.
You wound up on Cheers. That was your first job.
Yeah, that was our first job. Well, it was our first staff job. We had freelance stuff before.
Was that intimidating? Was that fun? What was that like?
Well, it was the most exciting phone call I ever had in my life. Uh-huh. John Stark and I were looping something, and the person who was running the loop says, there's a phone call for you. And it was Bill and Sherry, you know, telling us they'd read our spec script, which was a Murphy Brown spec script, and they loved it. And they said, would you come on the show? Would we? And we were so excited. But then dollars and cents for a minute, but looping is very, very lucrative. Now, it doesn't compare with television.
I was going to say, are you telling me you made more money looping than you did the first year on Cheers?
Yes. Because John and I had to split what one person gets.
Right.
And we were getting, I mean, when you loop back then anyway, I don't know what it's like now, it's probably better. You were getting $500 a day when you walk in the door, and then you get residuals as well.
Okay.
So looping, and it's in a dark room, there's no pressure. You know, by that I mean they don't even know who's talking half the time, especially if it's Walla.
Right.
I mean, you know, because we were improvisers, we did a lot of specifics. But when you didn't, you were walked in the door, you got your $500, and you were, you know, like anonymous all day. No pressure at all.
Uh-huh.
And around some very funny people all day.
I know a lot of improv people who did looping and had a company. And they would tell me stories that they would go in on jobs, there would be like German porno films that they would have to loop.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would then listen to them, and it was just like a riot.
It's
hearing
hysterical.
People that I know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, we had to do women coming and stuff
right,
like that.
Right,
but there are certain people that are famous loopers, like Renny Santoni is probably one of the most famous loopers. Number one, he could do a ball game from beginning to end and make it up.
Okay.
You know, make up the names, just invent the plays.
That's how I made my only voiceover living was doing play-by-play for various shows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the shot heard around the world was on MASH, right?
Yes.
He had to imitate that whole thing once for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
they had
the Russ Hodges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he had a disagreement with the showrunner.
I wasn't there then, by the way. I had left by that time. Yeah.
When he did this on some show, he had a disagreement with the showrunner who said, no, I think that it was this player that did that and stuff. And I think you've got that wrong. And Renny said, no, absolutely not. I have this memorized. This is exactly what it is. You know, but Renny was, it was like, you know, you go into those dark rooms, you know, you're going to be there from, I don't know, 10 in the morning until you don't know when.
Right.
Just like TV, only with the lights out.
Right.
And when you saw Renny Santoni walk in the door, you knew, oh my God, this is going to be a very funny day. Very fun. And Archie was that way too. I mean, there were other Archie Hahn and Harry Shearer was doing it, and Chris Guest was doing it, and I mean, I really could go on and on. There's just some great funny people in the room. But when Renny walked in, all of us just were like, all right, this is an easy day. Funny.
He was the man. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always harder for a woman writer, especially in comedy. How did you feel dealing with that? Was it a real tough adjustment for you?
You know, I never had that. First of all, I'm 10 years older than my writing partner, and I was 10 years older. And in Cheers, I was, 20, 30 years older than the boys running the, you know, Dan O'Shannon and Tom Anderson and Dan Staley and Rob Long were all in their 20s and brilliant. And, you know, I'd never written TV, and here I come in, and I'm in my 40s, and I'm a woman.
Uh-huh.
So that's the only job I ever felt. You know, I was going through menopause, so I was having, you know, what is it called, hot flashes?
Right.
And I'd be sitting in the room, and I would think, can they see the sweat on my face? My sweat. I'm dripping sweat. I want to run out of the room and rip off my clothes. Like, you know, I would just, and they were not particularly generous to me, those boys, you know. You know, it was hard enough to pitch at the beginning anyway. I'm sure I didn't open my mouth for the first, I don't know how long.
It's intimidating.
It's so intimidating. Yeah. The times when I would open my mouth was when David Lloyd he'd come in to do his day, right? He was
right.
A consultant. He'd close the doors. Nobody goes out for anything but the bathroom. And, you know, he'd leave when the sun went down. And he'd say, everybody works. Everybody talks. And so when you're in that situation, you know that guy's going to use no matter what you say. He's going to turn it into something that'll work. So you don't feel like a fool, you know. And on the days that David Lloyd was there, I would speak. You know, not much, but I'd speak.
You then did a show with Bob Newhart.
Yeah.
What's Bob Newhart
amazing.
Like?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, what's Bob Newhart like?
You know what Bob Newhart's
I
like.
I do.
He's so wonderful. You know, there are very few stars that come up to you when they don't like a joke or they don't like the wording. He'll say, instead of this, do you mind if I do this? That's Bob Newhart, you know. And you're
throwing
saying,
scripts on the floor and kicking them across the stage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he had a fix for everything that suited him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pleasure. And I don't think the network treated him very well at that time, actually. It was CBS, I think, and they, you know, they, that show, I thought that show was good, actually.
It's called Bob.
Yeah, and he was a cartoonist.
Right. Then I'm bouncing around a little bit, but you wound up on Ellen's situation comedy and the famous iconic episode where she comes out you and your partner wrote, and you won an Emmy for that.
Yes, we did.
Wow.
We were, yeah.
Yeah.
Television, you know, there's like 14, 15 people sometimes in the room. And so the credit for something like that is, you know, it lands on the person who wrote the script, but really that, if ever anything was a group effort, that show was. Dava Savelle and Mark Driscoll wrote the second half of that hour. We wrote the first half, which is where she ends up at the airport announcing that she's gay, which, by the way, she pitched, and which later I heard was on Wings, had been on Wings, but I don't even know that for a fact. I never saw that. But anyway, she won the Emmy also as a writer because she pitched that whole story. But my partner and I were, you know, only had to be at work on the Ellen show 2 days a week. And then we had something like 3 months to write, 22 minutes. And John was nervous about it. He kind of didn't want to do it. He believed in the cause and everything, but he was nervous about our career. He thought, you know, we could get slammed so badly because we'll be suddenly in the public eye, you know, or not the public eye, but we'll be, you know, getting these reviews. And I said, you know, do you think that in 3 months we can't write 22 minutes that's funny to us and that says look, she's pitched the story. I mean, what, you know, and we really had fun writing that, you know, as it turned out. And I don't know why John and I were actually chosen by either the studio or the network out of all those great writers.
You had been there for a few years.
We had been
by
there
then.
For four seasons.
And that
we
was
had
a
survived.
Revolving
yeah.
door,
We had
right?
survived
that,
every,
that
yeah.
series was a revolving door.
Yeah, I guess that had something to do with it. I never even thought about that. That makes sense. I just thought, you know, we were this neat, I don't know if I should say this, but anyway, we were a hetero couple. We weren't together, but neither of us was gay. And there were a number of gay people on the staff. And my feeling at the time was it made sense because here we were after four seasons writing about, you know, Ellen, who was having trouble in every episode keeping a relationship going with men. And now she was going to be with women, and I guess it shouldn't be any different. It's another person, that's all. It's just the right sex.
Right.
It should make a difference in a lot of ways, but not necessarily in terms of being able to be intimate. And so the next season I felt was going to be a big problem. So we left. You know, she cleaned house, but we didn't fight that.
Now, all of the writers that I know who have worked on that show at one time or another, let's just say they don't recall the experience in glowing terms.
I had an easier time than John did. John really had trouble on that show with her. I ended up sometimes being the person that, you know, soothes, you know, like the go-between.
Right.
I mean, we weren't in charge of anything, you know. Other people ran the show, so we didn't really have to meet with her, but occasionally we ended up in the meeting with her about a script. And he and she were like, you know, at each other sometimes, and that was hard for me. And, you know, I can give you an example of the way Ellen is.
Okay.
Okay. You know those things where you do a panel at the TV Academy?
Sure.
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. So we were in the last season that we were there. Might have been the coming out year. We did a panel, and all the writers were there. And, you know, when you leave work, you've left a script. It's like done, right? The next day was Thursday, which was blocking day. The next day after that was shooting day. We were done.
Great.
We felt like we were done.
Yeah.
And so it was a week where Chloe, the character Chloe, gets pregnant. And we deal with that.
Okay.
Okay, out of wedlock. So we're drinking at this thing before we do the panel. Everybody's having a wine or something. And so is Ellen, I think. I'm not sure. But anyway, so we're just about to go on stage. And she turns around. And I was behind Dava, who was the executive producer. Turns around to Dava. And I hear her say, by the way, I don't want Chloe to get pregnant this week. Now that, by the way, is somebody who doesn't understand how the process works, really.
Right.
I mean, why shouldn't she be able to say that? But she doesn't know when to say it. She didn't know when to say it. So anyway, so Dava then turns around and tells everybody we're going back to work after this thing, and everybody had been drinking.
Okay.
So we go out on stage, and then somebody says, you know, what's it like to work with Ellen? And we're all like, you know, in glowing terms, you know, talking about how great she is. And then we go back to the office, and we're grumbling, and everybody's really, really angry and a little drunk.
Right.
I think she felt bad, so she sent us a case of wine to the room.
Okay.
So,
which you broke into.
I don't drink, so I didn't have any of it. But I mean, I felt for, you know, people who had just had one or two glasses and they weren't sharp, you know.
Right.
And we knew we had to be there all night because we had to completely redo the story. So the next day, we found out that she was crying in her trailer. So the executive producer had to go there and talk to her. And found out that she was hurt because we didn't thank her for the wine. So you know what I mean? It's like it's a pattern of abuse in a way. Except it's like I don't think, you know, obviously it's not intentional. She didn't mean to be. She wasn't trying to be mean. She was insensitive to what our the way the job works.
Right.
And we had to pay the price for that. So that's a pretty typical thing. Now, I don't know what the situation is on the Ellen show now, on the talk show. I know that there are people
who complain.
People
who are on it. So
yeah, I actually do. And I know that they complain. And I would assume that it's those kinds of things. I don't think Ellen's a mean person. You know, I just think she can be insensitive. So.
Okay. You went on to create a
show. By the way,
I
got to say one other thing about her. She's like Bob Newhart. She's one of those people that you may be pitching on the floor, but if a joke doesn't work, she remembers all the jokes.
Okay.
From every script.
Okay.
That you did with that spot, in that spot.
So she can...
She'll just immediately come up with it, try another one from the script. And so she has an amazing memory.
And, of course, the audience thinks, my God, she can come up with these jokes right off the top of her head, when actually they were jokes that writers wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You went on and created According to Jim and had a nice writing career. I want to also talk a little bit about your relationship with Ricky Jay. Ricky Jay passed away recently, and you wrote a truly wonderful piece for my blog about your recollection of Ricky Jay.
You have no idea how happy I was that you asked me to do that. It was like, oh my God, this is the perfect thing. Because I just like randomly writing these things on Facebook, trying to deal with this shock.
Right.
And, you know, it's funny because remember I said to you that the first reaction to my article in your blog was this guy writing a nice tribute to yourself, a nice of you to mention Ricky Jay. Well, when, you know, I have to address that. I just want to say, because I felt that when I was writing, I thought, this is all about me. But what it really was his effect on me.
Right.
And I don't know how to write that. I didn't want to write about his accolades. You know, you can get
everybody,
that anywhere.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly. This
I knew Ricky in a specific way, in a specific time, and he had this really huge effect on me at the time. And he was my boyfriend, and we did live together. But the most important thing was I got an inside look into who I thought was an absolute genius. And, I mean, when I say most importantly, you know, after all, I'd say, you know, at the time, the relationship was the most important thing. But in retrospect, I learned the workings of a genius, you know, and the day-to-day dedication that he had toward magic and to cards in particular. To watch him with a deck of cards, to be living with somebody who's doing that with cards all the time.
Is he throwing cards at watermelons all day long?
He's aiming, though, and throwing it at things in your house. I mean, there really were cards literally every space on the floor. You were slipping all the time on cards.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he would go outside and throw a card over the house. you know, that kind of thing, and or just go to the beach. We lived at the beach. You'd throw them at the water. You know, he was a child with a deck of cards with a lot of skill, but a child up here, you know, kind of in his brain in terms of the fun that he had with cards.
Was there always a deck of cards in his hand when he's watching TV, when he's doing anything?
All the time. He didn't like to drive because he always was, you know, I was driving and he was, I was also cutting cards while I was driving, but he was.
Now he taught you all that stuff, right?
Well, that's not really how it worked. It's interesting because somebody wrote on Facebook that they were friends with him, and it's a woman, and she said, I asked Ricky why he let you in and let you see how the tricks were done. And he said, because she earned it. Well, that's a glorified version of kind of the way it really was. The only reason I saw how certain tricks were done was because I went to every show for a year.
Right.
That means parties. And that means if the party is crowded, somebody's going to end up standing behind him, which you're not allowed to do.
Right.
So if there's going to be anybody doing that, he's going to put me there.
Right.
Or his friend Spencer, who sometimes went with us. Somebody who cared about him and knew, you know. And so, yes, I saw things. And I do know things, but that doesn't mean I can do them. Or, by the way, I can't remember them.
But you can do all those, the card manipulations.
Yeah, so I was going to say how that happened was one time he went away. And I don't get stoned much, by the way. But this particular day, I don't remember how I got stoned because, I mean, I know it was pot, but I don't know whose it was because he didn't smoke it and I didn't smoke it. But I must have had some in the house and smoked it and was sitting, and I was actually in the car. I was sitting and I was doing a two-handed shuffle that's like one of the deck, half the deck on top of the other. I don't know how to explain that. Like your hands are vertical. And the way that you do this shuffle is you catch it at a certain corner, and it's every single card, one right after the other. And I picked up the deck, and I just did it. And I saw, I thought, oh, my God, I did this every other card, like, perfect. And I don't know how I did it. And so for the next 2 weeks, I tried to do that again. And I did it, finally, after it took me about 2 weeks. And I was hooked. I thought, you know, this is perfect. I'm doing this little thing, and it's perfect. And it was this way I learned from Ricky, because, you know, if you saw him manipulate cards, doing fans and shuffles, how beautiful it was and how perfect, that I could probably do that. And there was no stopping me. And he was a little bit upset when he saw that I was doing it when he came back. But he knew, you know, that I wasn't going to be stopped.
Right.
And so he put me together with a magic teacher, Michael Skinner. I think he's passed away since then. And to try to learn magic. But I didn't learn magic. I just learned, you know, I learned a lot of sleights. I can do a lot of those sleights, you know, different deals and stuff like that. Not some of the ones we were talking about, but some of them.
You wound up displaying this prowess on The Tonight Show.
I know.
Now, what did Ed McMahon think when he saw you?
That was
did
the
Ed
most,
McMahon I mean, go, hey, wait a minute.
Right. You know,
I managed you.
Off stage, I said, hey, Ed, how you doing? Yeah. Hi, Tracy. And, you know, he says, this is unusual. You've ended up doing this. And he said, are you still singing? And I said, yeah. And, you know, it was very cordial.
You didn't get me on The Tonight Show when you were managing me. But
he did.
Oh, he did?
I did.
Oh, okay.
I sang on The Tonight Show, but it was on the first 15.
Oh,
do you know what
okay.
That is?
Yes, the first 15 was pretty much New York.
Yeah,
and then because the Tonight Show originally was 11:15 at night to 1 a.m, and at 11:30, a lot of stations would join, and then at 12:30, a lot of stations would drop out. Yeah, it was
very a strange schedule, but the first 15 at that particular night, Joey Bishop was the host.
Okay.
So I sang two songs. Now, this is where I really learned show business again.
Okay.
Before I went on, the knowledge that Ed McMahon was my manager and that I was this cute young girl with a guitar who was just, you know, for the first time singing on The Tonight Show.
Right.
Every friggin' agent in town was there.
Uh-huh.
Okay. they made me wear a dress. I was, my costume, if you want to call it that, was pants and boots and a hat and,
right.
you know, a little gamine sort of thing.
Right.
And like a paper boy.
Uh-huh.
And they made me wear heels and a dress, and they put me on a stool and didn't tell me where to look. I mean, I literally had never.
Oh, wow. Been.
I sat on that stool wishing this was over.
Uh-huh.
And what it caused was I started singing Little Boxes, you know,
sure.
Little Boxes
mm-hmm.
made of ticky tacky.
Right. Became the theme song for Weeds.
Weeds, right. Mm-hmm. Malvina Reynolds wrote that song.
Okay.
Anyway, I started singing that and I got higher and higher and higher. And the band was playing with me too.
Right.
And so they had to stop, they had to drop out because I was starting to sing it sharper and sharper.
Uh-huh.
I destroyed my career and with one stroke. I got off the stage and no agents were there. And even Ed McMahon was a little bit, now what? Because
uh-huh.
he was my manager. He actually did get me work after that. But it was just, I remember, you know what? I was devastated and at the same time I was relieved. Because I thought, I can't do this. I really can't do this.
Uh-huh.
I was so scared on television, knowing that there were a million people watching, you know, or not even that really during the first 15, but it was, oh my God, it was horrible.
But so then you went on the Tonight Show again in the 70s,
in the 74,
doing these cards. And if you go to that, that blog post, you have the links.
Yeah.
So.
And, you know, the part of that, that we're not mentioning is that Johnny Carson's interest in cards was so great.
Because he himself was an amateur magician,
He
right?
was a magician, and when he heard that there was – I did the Bob Hope special. This was a couple of weeks before
Bob Hope hit on you?
No, you know what? I don't remember even meeting him.
Oh, okay.
That was terrible.
Oh, that's why.
But I had to do Diane Cannon's hands, you know,
uh-huh.
dealing cards in a sketch, and that was a live show, not live. It was shot in front of a live audience is what I mean. It wasn't broadcast live.
Right.
And so they stopped the scene. I entered with her blouse on.
Uh-huh.
I did the thing, which took a minute.
Right.
I took a bow and I left. And then they speeded up what I did. So it looked like she could really handle cards.
Uh-huh.
Well, during the rehearsals for that, I guess Johnny had heard that there was a woman who handled cards on the Bob Hope set. With his makeup bib on and everything, he came over there and met me. So I knew Johnny from that before I presented the sketch that I eventually did with Johnny, which I really wrote for me and Ricky Jay.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, he replaced Ricky.
Very cool. Well, it's an amazing career. You now have gone back to singing. And we're going to end by playing one of your songs. By the way, has anyone ever told you that you sound like Betty White?
No.
Okay.
You mean when I'm talking?
When you're talking,
no,
yes.
No,
when you listen back to this podcast.
I'll think about her.
You think about that and you go, yeah, because you do. You sound like Betty White. And
that's
by the
amazing.
Way, that's a compliment.
No, I
that
love
Betty
White.
That is a huge compliment. Yeah.
She went to my vocal coach too. I met her back then too.
Okay.
Yeah. But wait a minute. So, you know, I'm doing children's records now.
Okay.
It's website is... Well, besides my website.
Yeah, plug your website. Go ahead. Absolutely.
Well, first of all, there's TracyNewman.com, but it's called Run Along Home. And if you want to remember it this way, runalonghome.com, runalonghome.com.
It's a lot better than Cars for Kids.
Yes, it is. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Anyway, go to runalonghome.com, and I have two records. It's the or two CDs. It's the beginning of a series of age appropriate songs for little toddlers.
Okay,
and it's
my granddaughter.
I'm so proud.
I gotta
play
one for my granddaughter.
Yeah, I brought
yes,
you CDs.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you playing, by the way? What song are you playing? Like Lorraine or something?
No,
or
I am playing the Light Up the Weed.
Oh, Fire Up.
Yeah, Fire Up the Weed. Yeah.
Okay.
Because there's no children listening
no,
to this.
No.
Yeah.
It's what a fun song.
It is a fun song. Tracy, thanks so much. We'll do this again.
Yes, I hope so. Thanks, Ken.
Hollywood and Levine.
relationship works because we never talk. Except for make me some eggs, bacon and toast, and aren't you gonna wear socks? To be honest and true, what I like about you is that you're always high. You don't care if we never get out of the house, and neither do I. This must be the way we want it. This must be what we need. I'll make the martinis, and you fire up the weed. I have so much guilt attached to how we began, and that's what silences me. Snatched you up for myself, like the last piece of meat. Not that you didn't jump at the chance, old dog that you are. But I opened the door, patted the seat, and said, get in the car. Must be the way we want it. This must be what we need. I'll make the martinis, and you fire up the weed. I think that talking things through is overrated. I'd rather be blue and medicated. It took a few years and buckets of tears for me to understand why your ex never once even complained when I took her man. She was patiently waiting for a sucker like me to come on to the scene. Very good deed.
And that was Tracy Newman. She says that that song, by the way, is semi-autobiographical, to which I say, yikes. That will do it for this week. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, to Howard Hoffman, and to John Wolfert. If you want to get in touch with me for any reason, you can just email me at hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. That's hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. My Instagram account, if you want to follow me there, is Hollywood and Levine. Again, I would love a 5-star review. Darn, we're running late, so I don't have a chance to do my commercial plug for my website selling and licensing my plays. So you're just going to have to go to KenLevinePlays.com and see for yourself why it's such a wonderful deal. Again, thanks to Tracy Newman. We will talk to you again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.